Setlist in association with 7 Digital.
This week, Top 10 Legal Battles number 3, Prince v. Warner. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello there.
This is another of our special editions. It's the third in our new series of episodes looking back at some of our favourite music industry legal battles. This one, like the last, the Dancing Baby case, involves Prince. It's slightly tenuous because a lot of this never went to court.
Yeah,
most of this never went to court.
Most of this was legal sparring rather than actual litigation.
So it involved a lot of interpretations of contract law. And who doesn't want to listen to something about that?
Yeah, 55 minutes talking about American contract law. So yeah, whereas obviously the previous two special editions we've done in this series, we talked about the Blurred Lines case and the Dancing Baby case, which, as it happens, also indirectly involved Prince, and it was a Prince song, even though he himself wasn't involved. So those were two specific lawsuits that took years and years and years going through the system. In the case of Dancing Baby, a decade going through the system. And on the podcast, we were monitoring that lawsuit at every stage. Whereas this edition is looking at the long, drawn-out, tense relationship and war of words between Prince and his original record company, which was Warner Brother Records.
Yeah.
Which obviously is one of the most famous feuds in recorded music history, involving part of the business, involving one of the music industry's corporate entities. There is actually a lawsuit right at the end of this story.
Yes, it does get to court.
Although by that point, Prince was no longer with us.
No.
So, well, therefore, it seems that Prince wasn't that litigious. He liked to moan, he liked to shout, he liked to try and wangle his way out of contractual commitments. But it wasn't until he died that actual proper legal filings came about as a result of all of this.
Yes. So, as you said, we're going to discuss Prince's difficult relationship with Warner Brothers. Well, from the early 90s onwards, but actually, I mean, there were tensions in the 80s as well. There were probably tensions from when he signed his first deal as a teenager in 1978.
Yeah, so he signed to the Warner Brothers Record Company in the US all the way back in 1978, and obviously was then signed to the label throughout the 1980s, which obviously was when Prince became a massive artist, an acclaimed artist.
Yeah, I mean, it's fair to say Warner let him release a lot of flops before he became the hit artist that he did.
But it paid off.
It did pay off.
So well done to Warner for hanging on and allowing him to experiment and have some less successful releases in the early days. But then the hits started coming.
Yeah.
I remember there was that period in sort of the mid-80s, which is when Prince was becoming a superstar. And it was when Michael Jackson was becoming a superstar in his right as a solo artist rather than as that guy from the Jacksons. And I remember if you were reading the pop magazines of the time, so Smash Hits, for example, they were really trying to get a sort of a Michael Jackson-Prince feud going.
Well, I think there was a bit of a Michael Jackson-Prince feud.
But, I mean, in some ways, I mean, okay, they were both American pop artists who were very distinct from that moment, but also they were very different musically in many ways. Although Michael Jackson had a few run-ins with Sony over the years, but nothing compared with Prince's run-in with Warner Brothers. And as you say, although you do sense there were some tense moments in the 80s, I think, didn't he release one album and then ask Warner to delete it?
Yeah, so there was the Black album in 87 was released, and Prince had insisted on putting the album out even though Warner didn't really want to, and then they put it out, and then he said, oh, I don't want to put this out, withdraw it, and it was already in shops.
And obviously, we know that Prince was famously both incredibly prolific,
yes,
hugely prolific as an artist, and very eclectic in his prolific output, but also a bit of a perfectionist. And obviously, in the last edition, we were looking at the Dancing Baby case, and although really that wasn't Prince involved in that, Prince was famously fussy about his music popping up on the user-generated platforms, on the YouTubes, when people were like filming him at gigs. He was quite vigilante for a time of getting that content down, and you felt that wasn't a, I'm not being paid for this thing. It was a perfectionist thing. I'm not completely happy with that performance that you filmed, and I'm certainly not happy with your tinny,
the sound,
terrible recording of it. So I don't want it on there. So yes, famously prolific, but famously perfectionist. And as a result of that, yes, that album being an example, you sense that there probably were some tense moments in the 80s whilst that first contract that he'd signed with Warner Brothers was going through the motions. This was an era when artists signed quite long contracts with major record companies in which they were obliged to deliver a significant number of albums. and they couldn't go and record for any other label until those albums have been delivered, as is the norm with record contracts to this day. Once you've signed up to a label, you have to deliver records to that label, and you're not allowed to work with any other labels until those obligations have been met. But back in the 80s, you were signing deals where you were obliged to deliver a lot of albums under that deal. The record company would own all the copyright, the sound recording rights in those recordings for life of copyright, as was the norm then, actually still is in many deals today. And almost certainly the royalties that Prince was getting on those initial albums were rubbish. For the early albums, there probably weren't any royalties to be sharing in anyway. But once he became a hit artist, Warner were probably getting to keep most of the money. But this story really begins actually at the end of that first contract. He's delivered all the albums that he's due to deliver on the first contract. And now Warner Brothers are desperate to sign him to a second deal.
Well, really, in a way, that's the third, really, because his relationship with Warner, his initial relationship with Warner, I should say, was nearly 20 years. So he signed his first deal in 1978. 1985, he renegotiated his deal. As part of that, he got his own little vanity label, Paisley Park Records. At that point, it was just a label on his albums, I think. You know, it didn't really do anything.
Common tactic, we should note, with labels keen to keep superstar artists. There are various things you do with your superstar artists when you're trying to make sure they sign back to you. Obviously, big advance checks is one way. More favourable deals. Superstar artists, and this became more and more common as the 20th century went through the motions, often would try to negotiate back rights they'd given up in early deals in subsequent deals. And labels don't like that. So a good way to distract an artist who might be going in that direction is, oh, have you ever thought about being an A&R person? Have you ever thought about being an entrepreneur? Have you ever thought about being... I mean, all the rappers ended up with their own labels, didn't they?
Yeah.
And some of those people, I mean, like Jay-Z, he became a label guy. He set up a label, he genuinely signed artists. But yeah, we call them vanity labels because actually often they're just an imprint that only really appears on the artist's own records, or sometimes they get to pick an artist that is in essence signed to their label, but then the records are released under the vanity label's brand. So anyway, that was part of the mid-80s.
So there was that
agreement.
92, he renegotiates his deal again and signs again with Warner, sticking with them after all that.
By this point, the advance checks were getting...
Yeah, so the 92 deal... It was billed as a $100 million deal by his publicist, but it was, the deal was he got a 6-album deal, $10 million advance for each album, 25% royalty, and Paisley Park Records was upped to a full joint venture with Warner Brothers, where he did, I mean, he was quite a prolific A&R man. He did sign a lot of artists and work with a lot of artists, bring a lot of artists up. So it turned...
A point at which we should probably stop calling it a vanity label.
Exactly.
It becomes an actual label, an imprint of Warner Brothers.
Yes. And so there's that. So this, they were trumpeting this $100 million deal, which later on he would describe as being like slavery.
Yes. So quite a lot of cash on the table up front, which... As far as I'm aware, was never part of the deal. Well, certainly, the slave was not getting £10 million for writing some pop songs.
One of the points of contention in the negotiations had been that he wanted to release records more prolifically than Warner was comfortable with. Warner was pushing for one album every 2 years. They settled on one every year.
And that's an interesting point, isn't it? So I said that what is known about Prince is he was very prolific and a perfectionist. So during those first couple of deals, the perfectionism... You sense sometimes a bit of an issue, particularly with that album that he was insistent they release and then he didn't want them to release. But yeah, by the early 90s, it was him being so prolific. And I suppose he was at that point in his creative career where he was just writing and recording and music was coming out all the time. And by the 90s, it was rare for big name artists signed to major labels to be releasing records more frequently than every 2 years. I think earlier... Like in the 70s, one album a year wasn't as unusual. But I suppose by the 90s, the CD era was booming, the money was flowing in, but a real sort of structure had been built around the major record companies. They had their marketing campaigns, they had their ways of doing things, they had their systems for putting the record out and then doing a little bit of discounting down the line. And I suppose their system by this point was based around at least a 2-year turnaround. So therefore, that's interesting, isn't it? That by the mid-90s, Prince, in some ways ahead of his time, had this all been happening 15 years later, if you had an artist saying, I want to bring something out new every 6 months, every 3 months, do you remember in the early days of iTunes, there was talk that that might become the way it worked?
Yeah.
I think Ash brought out a track a month 1 year.
Yeah.
And Jack White dabbled with putting out EPs on a much more regular basis. And I suppose actually we have seen, since the streaming boom, the EP thing becoming much more common. So certainly once it all went digital, there was lots of talk about, well, actually, why do artists put out 10 or 12 tracks every 2 to 3 years? Why don't they put out things more often? So had all this been happening 15 years later, then maybe Warner could have said, all right, then, seems like an interesting experiment. Let's do that. But yes, they wanted to do one album every 2 years. Prince wanted more often than that. The compromise was one a year, but that was a compromise. Prince wanted more frequently than that.
And I think quite quickly he started turning up, because he was working really prolifically, he started turning up with new albums all the time, as far as I can tell, and saying, I really want to put this out. And Warner would say, but we're still promoting the last album.
Also, they committed $10 million advance per album. I mean, that's quite a lot of cash flow. If he's arriving with a new album every month, we can't afford to be writing checks for $10 million every month, let alone the marketing and the distribution.
So there's that. That was a point of contention. He was also unhappy that Warner owned his masters, which, I mean, that was still the norm back then. It still is now, really, but less so in a lot of cases, that big artists do end up keeping their own masters.
Yeah, I suppose most new talent deals with a major record company, the recording rights are going to the label, and negotiations will begin with life of copyright, that the label is getting ownership of those masters for life of copyright. So that is still very much the starting point that major labels, when they sign new talent, are negotiating. But two things. A, indie labels now will very much negotiate on those rights returning to the artist at some point in 20 years, 10 years, sometimes a shorter time period now. So there is starting to be more negotiation on that with new talent deals. But certainly that's the point, that by the time you're doing your second or third deal with a major record company as a superstar, we are now in an era where very much you have a negotiating power, and you would be expecting it's a licensing deal, that the label will have the rights for a period of time, but then you will still be the owner and you'll get them back. Whereas, this was Prince many albums into his career, many albums into his relationship with Warner Brothers Records, and not getting the rights. So that was another thing on the list of tensions. This was starting to build.
And so quite quickly into that deal, like a year pretty much, he decided he wanted out. He wanted more freedom to release music as he saw fit. But he just signed this 6-album deal. What do you do? You're in a contract. How are you going to get out of it? He came up with a ruse, and that was to change his name to an unpronounceable symbol.
Yeah, and this is where the tensions between Prince and Warner Brothers Records become about record contracts, and it becomes about legalities and technicalities.
And it's where it becomes public as
and
well.
It becomes much more public because, Prince, very early into this 90s deal with, in theory, 6 albums to deliver, and at Warner's insistence, that meant 6 years because they were saying, we're not putting out more than you. He would probably be like, well, here's 6 albums. Yeah. Done. And they were like, no, we've got 6 years of promo to do, even if you've done all the writing and recording already. And so Prince wanted out of his deal quite quickly. So the question is, well, how do you get out of your deal? And it's always quite interesting, if you look at record deals, particularly major label record deals today, those deals are usually pretty damn long.
Yeah.
And it's quite interesting.
I mean, you've described deals as long twice now, but you mean different ways long.
Yes.
They used to be years long. Now they're just a lot of pages.
A lot of pages to the actual physical contract to which the artist is putting their signature. And over the years, over the history of the record industry, you're right. Contracts have got shorter in time, in that generally artists are not committed to deliver so many albums as they used to be. But in terms of pagination, certainly for major label deals, they've got longer and longer and longer. And it's always interesting when you look at record deals. I mean, the stuff at the start is all quite straightforward. It's about how many records, and it's about copyright ownership, and it's about marketing commitments and promo and blah, blah, blah. All that's up there at the front. But as you work your way through the contract and you get into more of the nitty-gritty, you start looking at terms on like page 37 of the contract. And behind all of those terms, once you get that far into the contract, there's clearly a story behind. Why is this in here? Something has happened. Somebody has tried something at some point in the last 50 years that necessitated this term being added to the contract.
And several of those will be because of Prince.
Several of those will be because of Prince. So, for example, a record contract will usually say, once you sign to the label as an artist, you are committed to deliver a certain number of albums to the label, and you're not allowed to record with anyone else until those albums have been delivered. And often it's a global deal, so you can't work with any other label anywhere else in the world until you've delivered your albums. That's quite standard in a record contract. Of course, it's always worth referencing. That's a one-way commitment. The label is not obliged to release all of those albums.
Yeah.
Usually they're only obliged to release one. In fact, sometimes they're not even obliged to do that. So it's a one-way commitment. So as an artist, you're obliged to deliver 5 albums, but the label is only obliged to release one of them and can ultimately cut you free from the deal if they decide that they don't want the other albums, although they were never going to do that with Prince. But at various points in history, as people are trying to get out record contracts that they regret signing, one ruse would be to say, well, I signed this contract as one performer name, so performer name X, that might be your real name or it may be a name you use on stage. And so I am restricted to release music as that artist with any other label until I've delivered my 3, 4, 5, 6 albums under this deal. But what if I start releasing under another name? Because the contract only talks about my performance name. What if I release under another name and then I could be cut free from that contract? So once one artist has tried that, then everybody's contracts from that point onwards, all new contracts have to be updated that say, okay, this contract covers you as a person and your current performance name, and any other name that you might think of at any point in the future is covered by this deal. So you can't be sneaky and say, I'm going to change my name and therefore I'm no longer covered by this deal. So that becomes quite standard. So yeah, you sense that what happened here was, what Prince said was, okay, trying to get out of this contract, can't change my name because they've already thought of that, so my deal won't let me do that. So I can't release under the name Prince, and I can't release under any other name, but what if I didn't have a name? Yeah. And so begins the era of Prince becoming a symbol.
Yes. So he said at the time, the first step I have taken towards the ultimate goal of emancipating from the chains that bind me to Warner Brothers was to change my name from Prince to this unpronounceable symbol. Prince is the name my mother gave me at birth. Warner Brothers took the name, trademarked it, and used it as the main marketing tool to promote all of the music that I wrote. The company owns the name Prince and all related music marketed under Prince. I merely became a pawn used to produce more money for Warner Brothers.
So the name Prince was no longer being used.
Yeah, well.
Well, I suppose that's the point, isn't it? Officially, he was now releasing music using this symbol. Now, the symbol actually pre-existed this decision.
Yeah, so the first album under this 6-album deal, the title was this unpronounceable symbol. It was generally referred to as the Love Album or the Love Symbol Album. And so that symbol already existed. And then he took it on and said, well, this is my name now. You can't call me Prince anymore. I'm not Prince anymore. They sent out floppy disks to all the media organisations with that symbol on so they would have it in their fonts so they could produce it correctly. Generally, he was referred to as the artist formerly known as Prince, or often for brevity, Prince.
Or sometimes the artist.
Or the artist, yeah.
But yes, if...
Or Squiggle.
Or Squiggle. But if those people who chose to abbreviate it to Prince, it was kind of defeating the point, wasn't it? But yeah, you sense this was just one of various efforts to get out of his deal. But it didn't work, and indeed, as I say, if you look at a record deal now, it will probably say, under this name, any future name, or any other symbol or manifestation or concept of a name is covered by this deal. So, well, this was a period where it felt like Prince kept coming up with ruses to either get out of his commitments to Warner, or at least to annoy Warner.
Yes, because he never got out of his commitments.
And Warner then kept calling his bluff. So he was like, well, I'm going to change my name. And Warner were like, that's fine, change your name. We'll just carry on releasing your records, but we'll put this silly symbol on the artwork instead of your name. That's fine, we can deal with that. So yeah, it didn't work. He didn't get out of his deal. And we just had a series of Warner-released albums, which were officially released by the artist formerly known as Prince.
Yeah, so his next ruse after that was to announce that he was retiring from recording, because if he doesn't record any new music, Warner can't have any new music.
Although, of course, the downside of that is, because it's a 6-album deal, so it's not a specific period of time, it's 6 albums. If you just stop recording, in theory, that deal then lasts forever.
Yeah.
So it almost has the opposite effect of what he wanted. But because Prince had been so freaking prolific for the previous 10 years, he was actually sitting on a whole load of unreleased recordings. So you sort of sense that, having realised that by retiring and not recording, he'd then be locked to this deal forever, his next solution was to say, oh, well, there's all this stuff over here that we've not released before. That could be my 6 albums.
Yes, you'll just have to pull all my future albums in this deal from my archive, which another bluff that Warner called.
Yes, and we'll do that.
So I think they started by putting out the Black Album, the one that he demanded they pull.
Yes, because they'd already done all the work on that.
And they also put out Greatest Hits, which was something he really didn't want to happen.
Yeah,
he was very much of the opinion that Greatest Hits only came at the end of an artist's career, either when they died or they'd just been spent artistically.
Which isn't true.
He didn't feel he was either of those things.
It's very common for Greatest Hits albums to come out at the end of each contract period. But I suppose for an artist as prolific as Prince, and an artist who every couple of years shifted quite significantly artistically and creatively, didn't like the idea of Warner just putting out the hits from the mid-80s packaged together in an unimaginative way. And so, yeah, again, it was Prince saying, OK, just use my archives, take 5 years to release it, and then at least at the end of that, I'll be cut free. But then Warner managed to piss him off by doing what he told them to do.
Yep, he also set up his own independent label, NPG Records, where he started releasing music outside the Warner deal. Although I think generally he was not putting his name on them. I think he initially tried to put his name on them and Warner threatened him with legal action. So at least one of those, he was credited under another name. I think lots of them, he was not credited at all. And he pretended that, even though I think lots of them were just him on his own, he pretended other people had made that music. But the second of those albums was Exodus, which was a rallying call to other artists to leave their labels and go it alone, proclaiming that exodus had already begun, even though it hadn't. But when you read up on this, it comes out quite a lot that this really bugged Prince for the rest of his life. He was really, really annoyed about all of this. And behind the scenes was quite often needling other artists, saying, you've got to leave your label and go it alone. Cut yourself from these bindings. And I think that generally those artists didn't listen to him.
We mentioned at the start that, surprisingly almost, this never actually properly got to court. And I mean, this was going backwards and forwards for a number of years. And yeah, so Prince trying ways to get out of his commitments to Warner, and then trying to meet those commitments in the laziest, most annoying way possible. But yeah, launches his own label, having been given this label under the Warner Brothers banner, but then launches a totally separate label. And it's an interesting period in the late 90s and then actually into the early days of digital that you have him releasing records through the NPG label. Which is interesting, A, because that was really testing Warner, because in essence, that was breach of contract. So yeah, I say it is surprising that this didn't end up in court. But having said that, through all of this, Prince became a sort of early innovator. I mean, fans of punk would say that the punk artists were all doing this all the way back in the 70s, and probably you could go back even further than that. But he did sort of become an innovator in the direct-to-fan thing, in the having your own artist business and your own artist label, and having a sort of a much more prolific kind of fan club type model, which then ultimately shifted online. And that was always the irony of Prince, when he ultimately became a bit of a Luddite with the whole user-generated content thing. In the early days of digital, because he'd become this DIY, I'm not part of the machine, he was a real innovator in doing online stuff and direct-to-fan stuff when he was desperately trying to get the music out that Warner wouldn't release.
So things came to a bit of a head in about 1994 when he turned up with a new album called The Gold Experience, told Warner he wanted to release it on his 37th birthday, 7th of June 1994. And Warner said, well, we put out the Black Album in November and we've got this other album called Come set for August, so we can't stick another album in between that.
Bearing in mind, Prince had told them that they should just start releasing all of his archive recordings and get a schedule going one a year to fulfil this contract. And then in the midst of all of that, after Warner were basically doing what he had asked, then he comes up with a new album with, OK, I need this to be released now, which screws up the plan that Warner had put in place with the archive stuff.
He then insisted, he said, well, if we've got to put out a single from this album, it's very important. That single was The Most Beautiful Girl in the World. And Warner said, we're not going to put out that single because we're not putting out this album. If you want to put that single, once again calling his bluff, at a point when Prince called their bluff of them calling his... It was multi-layers of bluff.
Lots of bluffing.
Warner said, you can put out a single, that's fine, but you have to pay for it yourself and we won't put it out. You can put it out on this MPG label you've got. So he did that. He stumped up $2 million of his own money and put that single out.
And it was a hit.
It was a big hit.
Meanwhile, Warner were putting out all the stuff no one was interested in.
But it was that really buoyed him and made him think, oh, I really could make it as an independent artist. I need to get out of this deal. And then that accelerated his attacks on Warner. It's kind of after that he started appearing in public with Slave written on his face.
Yes, and I suppose, although this never got to the courtroom, it became in the public sphere, in the media, more and more nasty. And obviously, as often the case in these scenarios, generally the labels stay quite quiet because it's a tricky PR thing to be being confrontational. Meanwhile, the artist is doing the media circuit. Now, it has to be said, actually, during this point of his career,
Prince wasn't
doing the media circuit. But when he did make public appearances or the rare interviews he gave, he was very much laying in to Warner and promoting the idea that he had his own label that was slowly but surely growing. And as I say, ultimately became quite a big thing, and calling on other artists to do the same, generally unsuccessfully, and laying into Warner at every possible opportunity.
Yes, so he turned up to the Brits in 1995 with Slave written on his face, which is like all the other music executives in the room there. So that's a bold move. Not just turning up to a TV studio. It's turning up to everyone you're calling a slave.
Yeah, the record
and having it written on your face saying, this is what you're doing to me.
At their big night out.
He won a prize. He gave an acceptance speech, which went, Prince, best. The Gold Experience, better. In concert, perfectly free. On record, slave.
So there you go. Make of that what you will.
He then, he said he hadn't been doing the media circuit, but shortly after that, he did give an interview to the BBC. I remember watching it. It was a weird interview because he had his face covered and he didn't speak directly to the interviewer. He whispered all his answers into the ear of his dancer, Maite Garcia, who later became his wife, and she relayed the answers. So that was odd. He was also, at that time, he was promoting a tour, which was promoting the Gold Experience, which at that time had still not come out. So it was a very odd period where he went on a tour promoting an album that you could not buy. And in fact, part of the backdrop for the stage set said, like, it had a picture of the artwork and just said, release date never on it. So he was really fighting this, as you say, in the court of public opinion. Though it has to be said, a lot of the time he was losing that battle because his actions seemed so erratic and so odd. He just sort of became a figure of fun, really.
Yeah, and the whole artist formerly known as and the symbol became a bit of a running joke, didn't it? And it's weird, really, when you think about it, because, an incredibly talented big artist. His period as being a sort of chart-topping, crowd-pleasing pop artist was really in the 80s, and he was creating some more challenging stuff by this period. But nevertheless, I think everyone would agree, an incredibly talented songwriter, producer, performer, guitarist, singer, everything, yeah. Taking on the big, bad, evil corporate machine, one of the major record companies. Obviously, Warner also, at that point, the label was part of the bigger Warner Entertainment conglomerate. So in some ways, that you would have expected there to be a lot more popular opinion siding with Prince. But I think perhaps because, as you say, by this point in his interviews and his public performance, it was going through his particularly weird period. And I think it just made him feel quite distant.
Yeah.
And maybe it was because we all knew, because his publicist had told us, that he had been paid millions and millions and millions, tens of millions of pounds by Warner. So maybe there was an element of, well, if you take that much money off the man, maybe you should do what the man tells you.
The Gold Experience did eventually come out, I should add, that September. But by then the tour was long finished. And he only ever toured Europe on that. I don't think he went to the US with that tour. But I don't think he toured the US until after the Warner deal was complete, which it did finish. He did eventually get to the end of those six album commitments. In 1996, he released Chaos and Disorder, which was an album he'd recorded in 10 days and littered with digs at Warner.
And that was that 1990s contract finally fulfilled.
Yes. So free of his record contract, he was finally able to release music as he saw fit.
And this was the period, which I alluded to earlier, when the MPG thing really started to take off. The Director Fan thing started to take off. Obviously, a few years later, a lot of it shifted online. Although there were some bigger album releases, and I suppose it's interesting that for an artist who'd been so critical of the major label machine, an early advocate of the DIY artist, the independent artist, we can do this on our own, some of the big albums that followed the Warner era, he did partner with major record companies to release them.
Yeah, so his first album out of his Warner deal was the three-hour triple album Emancipation, which he released in partnership with EMI. It doesn't exist anymore, but it was a major label, Children, as well as experiment with the Director Fan and online releasing music. One of the big experiments he did was to release his 2007 album Planet Earth free with the Daily Mail.
That was in the UK.
That was in the UK.
Not everywhere.
He did that deal with the Daily Mail, but had not told his label, Sony, that he was doing that.
Yeah, so by that point,
which was another dispute with the label, because then Sony pulled out, decided not to release the album in the UK at all.
Yeah, by that point he was partnering.
Because if you give away 2 million copies of it, what's the point?
So by that point, he was working with Sony on his releases, albeit again in a slightly more partnership fashion. But yeah, he did that deal. Mail on Sunday, technically. Let's be correct here. And I remember because during that era, I had worked on a few of those artist-specific cover mount CDs that came out with the Mail on Sunday. And
not this one specifically.
Not this one specifically, although it kind of copied a model that I'd been involved in setting up, which was because obviously cover mount CDs, which, I mean, by this point were already very controversial within the music community. The record shops hated the cover mount CDs, and a lot of people in the music community, because the majors had all done deals with the newspapers who became cover mount CD obsessed in the early 2000s. And the majors had done catalogue deals with agencies who then worked with the newspapers to do compilations. So there was that period where at least once a month, most of the Sunday papers would have a classic rock or a love song or a soundtracks compilation. And so how many of these compilations can you have? And people felt that it was devaluing music. Obviously, this was also the era when piracy was booming and the internet age was coming in. So they had this notion of music being devalued was a big talking point. And so these cover mount CDs were quite controversial. As I say, I was involved in some projects where we started to make them artist-specific. And usually the ones that we did was artists performing old tracks in order to promote a new album.
Right.
So we were kind of justifying it. I'm not sure we succeeded, but we were justifying it to the critics of cover mounts in the music community by saying, OK, well, we've taken the cover mount concept, but rather than it being yet another cheesy love song compilation, and rather than it being a brand new album, we are using artists performing their classic tracks in order to get everybody paying attention to the fact that there's a new album they can go buy in the shops. So actually, we felt that we turned it into a great promotional platform. And then Prince came along and said, well, rather than doing that, why don't I just put out the album through the mail on Sunday? As you say, pissed off Sony, who had the rights to release that album in the UK. They didn't take those rights. Pissed off the retailers, because the retailers didn't like cover mount CDs. I seem to remember the compromise there was letting HMV sell the Mail on Sunday on the weekend when the album came out. I'm not sure that was really much of a compromise. But yes, he continued to innovate, I think is the point, in how he put out his music, both through the director fan channels and with the bigger releases.
Yes, and through all of this, it still really niggled him, this thing with Warner. And of course, the other thing with the 92 Warner deal was that it wasn't just for recordings, it was with Warner Chappell as well, with his publishing. And he was locked into that until 2000. So that deal carried on for a few years after he got out of the recording side of it. But an interview in 1999 with Paper Magazine, he was still so annoyed about it. He told them, "I wanted to buy my masters back from Warner Brothers. They said no way. So I'm going to re-record them, all of them. Now you will have two catalogues with pretty much exactly the same music, except mine will be better. And you can either give your money to Warner Brothers, the big company, or to NPG. You choose." Now, I don't think he ever did that. If you look at recent reporting on Taylor Swift saying that she might do this in the Simi Daily, I went through the reasons why that's very difficult to do. Def Leppard attempted to do that, and they only got about two songs into it because they found actually re-recording the vocals from 30 years previously quite difficult, let alone the feel and sound of any of the rest of it.
If the idea is, as Prince was suggesting in that interview at the end of the 1990s, that you're going to recreate them exactly as they were originally released, obviously you can do new versions, you can do acoustic versions, modern versions, but to completely replicate how you were singing 20 years earlier, as Def Leppard were very candid about when they tried it, it's actually a really hard thing to do. But yeah, even when he was out of the Warner Records contract, still dissing Warner, when he was out of the Warner Chappell contract, still dissing Warner, and actually even, obviously, with the Daily Mail thing, we were all the way into the 2000s, into the iTunes era, but I mean, well into the 21st century. I mean, he wasn't quite as repeatedly vocal about Bloody Warner in the 2000s, but you sensed that he was still incredibly pissed off about everything that happened.
It really annoyed him, the whole thing. And so, I mean, so it's surprising in 2014 when he decided to sign a new record deal. Even more surprising that he signed that record deal with Warner Brothers.
Yes. So we did almost, as it turns out, not, more on which in a minute, but almost we came full circle and we got some closure. Because in 2014, it was announced, and as I say, it was a surprise because even though by this point it all felt like a very long time ago, we knew that very recent to this, all the word was that Prince was still mightily pissed off about everything that happened back in the 90s. But the announcement came out that Prince was signing a new deal with Warner, which would see him reclaim many of his master rights in the US, but at the same time, licensing those rights back to Warner and participating in promotion around a whole load of re-releases. Because I suppose that's the other thing to say, that because of the bad blood between Prince and Warner, in the years that followed the end of that 1990s contract, and as we went into the iTunes era, when everyone was pushing the music online and trying to do new stuff with the music online, obviously Prince wouldn't promote any catalogue stuff for Warner. So Warner couldn't exploit the catalogue that they were sitting on in any proactive way. So that was part of this deal in 2014, that yes, Prince would be getting some of those masters that he'd wanted back in the late 1990s, but on the condition that he would participate in some re-releases of the classic albums in partnership with Warner Music.
And license new music to Warner. So it wasn't a direct recording relationship, but he was basically recording music for Warner again.
And new material, as you say.
And new material. Which was weird. So, you know, after all that, he still went back to them. Although, I mean, it was only one album that he did for Warner, and then he went back to putting out stuff just under the NPG banner. He was pretty prolific for a little while with new music, although this following year he died, which did put a stop to that.
It did, definitely. But even Prince, arguably one of the most prolific artists of the last century, yes, death did stop the music coming out. One quick thing to say about that 2014 Warner Music deal, with hindsight, is he did get back master rights for the classic albums in the US as part of that deal. As I say, the quid pro quo was that he would work on the promotion of a whole load of re-releases. The reason why that has actually come back up since then...
Yes, because actually he got the rights back. He was licensing them back to Warner.
Correct. And the reason why that deal has come back up in more recent times is, although this has never been officially confirmed by either side, it is understood that one of the reasons why Prince, and there was one particular lawyer who was working with him at this time who led the negotiation on these deals, the reason that they were able to get that deal in 2014 with a return of master rights in the US, bearing in mind this was not 15 years after that interview where he was saying, I want my master rights back and they won't give them to me. Well, I suppose there were various things. First of all, complete change of guard at Warner.
Yeah.
Because Warner had been sold twice by this point. Yeah. Completely new ownership, completely new management. None of the people he'd fallen out with back in the 90s were still there. Second, we've got all of this catalogue. We're not exploiting it properly. If we can get Prince to help us with the promo, then huge opportunity there. But thirdly, this whole termination rights stuff that we've been talking about on set list, on the proper set lists in recent months, that under American copyright law, there is this one opportunity 35 years after a copyright assignment deal has been done, via which music creators can get their rights back. Now, we're not going to go into this in any great detail because it's not the purpose of this podcast. But it's generally agreed now.
Except that it was another legal element to this, which justifies it being in our top 10 legal battles.
Exactly.
Series.
Good point. So it's generally agreed now in America that if you're a songwriter and you do a publishing deal with a publisher and you assign your rights to that publisher, that 35 years later, you have this one opportunity under law to terminate that contract and get your rights back. Only in the US, but nevertheless, it's there. Now, actually, these days, you wouldn't be assigning your rights to a publisher for more than 35 years anyway. But back in the 70s and the 80s, life of copyright assignments on publishing were very common. So you've got all of these songwriters coming out of the woodwork 35 years later, getting their rights back. And that's all now pretty standard in America. But the big question mark is, should this principle apply to sound recordings? And the record companies insist not. And this is all to do with technicalities in copyright law. Basically, the labels are saying, by our understanding of record contracts and American copyright law, we are the default, original, first owners of the copyright in all the master recordings that we create with our artists. So therefore, there isn't an assignment. The artist isn't transferring the copyrights over. We're the copyright owners. So therefore, no assignment, no termination right. And the labels are continuing to insist that that is the way the law should be interpreted. Plenty of artists and lawyers of artists disagree. And as we record this podcast, there are some test cases in the American courts with sort of middle-level heritage artists who are trying to get that principle disproven in court, that actually a termination right does apply to sound recordings. But as it currently stands, the labels would say not. But we, in some cases, know, and in other cases, suspect that superstar artists have negotiated back the American rights in their master recordings by threatening to test this in court, because what the majors don't want is a superstar artist fronting one of those test cases.
Yeah.
And so it was widely assumed that Prince's legal team had used that to force Warner's hand, which is, okay, complete change of personnel, you recognise the advantage of a catalogue marketing campaign, and if you don't do this deal and you don't let Prince get back his master rights in the US, we'll take this as a test case in court. And the last thing you want is a Prince-led test case on the termination rights.
Yeah, the policy of bluff calling with Prince was well and truly over.
And the people at Warner who had called all these bluffs in the 90s were no longer there.
Yeah.
So, yeah, this deal was done in 2014, a multi-layered deal which saw Prince get his rights back in the US. He then licensed them back to Warner. They then did some re-releases. He did the promo on the re-releases. They still had the rights elsewhere in the world. And as you say, there was new material which technically was still being released through his own label, MPG, but then licensed to Warner. So Prince and Warner were buddies again before his tragic, untimely death in 2015. But as we alluded to at the start, that 2014 contract was multi-layered and quite complicated. After his death, we learned it was really complicated, which is how this whole story finally ended up in an American courtroom.
Yeah, because actually since his death, there's been quite a lot of court action surrounding Prince personally and with his music, particularly with his music.
Not least because he had a number of siblings who are basically the estate.
Yes, well, that was one of the things that happened in court. He left no will and he had no children, so the court had to decide who his heirs were. Quite a lot of people came forward and said, I would like a bit of his fortune, thank you. And eventually they decided on a small number of siblings and half-siblings.
And those siblings have then split off into two factions.
Yes.
So obviously, once Prince had died and the Prince estate had finally been set up and people had been appointed to run that estate, I mean, these were people sitting on a phenomenal archive of music, both the released recordings, but also a phenomenal amount of unreleased recordings. And the Prince brand and all of his legacy, the songs, the recordings, etc., etc. So we knew that there was going to be, once the estate was set up properly, a number of deals. But yeah, one of the reasons why there have been extra layers of legal technicalities around all of those deals is you've got these two factions of siblings represented by different lawyers who pretty much can't agree on anything.
Yes.
So whenever one of these deals comes up, there's always some dispute between the different respective beneficiaries of the estate as to which deals they should be doing.
But quite a lot of deals were done while they were still one faction. In fact, it's these deals that split them, really. But they did a number of deals with Universal over recording, publishing and merchandising rights. The recording rights alone, that was reported to be over a $30 million deal, covering recordings that Prince had released through MPG Records since the mid-90s and a load of previously unreleased stuff. I mean, basically, they got access to his vault, plus some of his most famous records. And then it was sort of suggested that as things came out of Warner deals, they would be handed over to Universal as part of this new deal.
Yeah, so once the estate was set up, they were basically shopping around these opportunities to all of the majors, demanding multi-million dollar advances, as you say, to control the merch rights, to control the publishing rights, but yeah, to control the recording rights. And when the latter deal, because actually, although all three of those deals ultimately were done with Universal, they were all announced separately.
Yeah.
And when the recording deal was announced, well, it was confusing. Because, as you say, the MPG released stuff. That's quite straightforward.
Yeah.
Began in the mid-90s when
Prince owned some stuff.
Yeah.
You have it now.
And he'd released an awful lot over 20 years on that, including some quite recent stuff. So that's quite straightforward. The archive, quite straightforward. A whole load of unreleased recordings. But then, yeah, it was clear that some of Prince's most famous albums and most famous tracks would ultimately be part of this deal. And if we're being honest, although, you know, Prince put out some very interesting stuff in the latter part of his career, most of the big albums and the big tracks are from the Warner era.
Yeah.
And so it's like, well, that's interesting that you seem to be getting some control over the tracks which were Warner tracks. And that deal from 2014, okay, we knew that some rights went back to Prince as part of that deal, but we also know that Warner carried on releasing that music. It didn't help that prior to his death, Prince had done a deal with Tidal.
Yes.
And removed all of his content off the other streaming services.
Yes.
And at the same time they announced the Universal
deal. I mean, the Tidal deal also ended up in court.
Well, it's one legal wrangling too many for this podcast.
Yes.
But
just accept that that happened and move on.
Yes, after his death, Prince never sued Tidal or Jay-Z, but the estate did.
Well, Prince did an exclusivity deal for two albums on Tidal, and then the estate said, there's no deal for the second of those albums, so you can't have it. Even though, I mean, Prince had been very public about definitely wanting to do this.
But it seemed that Prince and Jay-Z had done a deal without writing anything down. But anyway, my point is, that at the same time that the Universal deal was announced on recordings, Warner announced that the Prince catalogue was coming back to the other streaming services.
Yeah.
And so it's like, well, this is confusing. I've got one press release telling me that Universal now control these releases. Another press release from Warner telling me that they're putting these things back on streaming services. What the hell is going on here? And ultimately, that deal with Universal between the Prince Estate and Universal Music over the recording catalogue ended up in court, where what I've just said was said many times. What the hell is going on
here?
Yes,
because we were not the only people confused, which was quite reassuring. Universal were very confused. It started very quickly to express concern that some of the music they thought they were going to get to represent, they actually weren't. They weren't clear about what they had actually got the rights to, because prior to doing the deal, they hadn't seen the Warner deal, because why would Warner hand over their deal while another label is negotiating something that they potentially want for themselves? So Universal went to court and they got a judge to say that Warner had to hand over their deal so that someone could work out what Universal actually had the rights to now.
And whether or not they had got the rights to the things they thought they got the rights to when they wrote the cheque for $30 million.
So the lawyers went away, they went through these contracts with a fine tooth comb, and they came back to the court, and the court said, okay, what have you worked out? And they said, we don't know, we don't understand this contract, it makes no sense.
Yes, Universal were very, very confused about what rights had and had not been transferred from Warner to Prince back to Warner.
By the time they got to that stage, they were not only confused about what rights they had, they were confused about what rights Warner had. And so ultimately they asked the judge to rescind their $30 million recordings deal, which the judge did. So that was fun.
Yeah, so all of this had to go to court, actually, because it's part of his estate. And in the absence of a will and all the confusions around the estate, all of the things happening with these post-deals are subject to court approval. And yeah, ultimately, Universal asked the court to get rid of the recordings deal. They said, we're happy with the merch deal. We'll keep that. Thank you very much. Publishing, brilliant. We'll carry on publishing the songs. But recordings, we want our $30 million back, which then posed an interesting question because, well, clearly the estate were like, OK, we need to go and find somebody else to do this deal. And I mean, if you want that big in advance and somebody capable of properly distributing those recordings, probably there's only Sony or Warner.
Yeah.
And what we thought, because we applied some logic, well, if no one can get their head around this Warner contract, by far the simplest thing would be for the estate to do a deal with Warner. So then it doesn't matter what's in the Warner contract.
Yeah.
Except that, obviously, that would reduce the estate's negotiating power to an extent.
Yeah.
So perhaps that's why we shouldn't have been surprised that ultimately they did a deal with Sony.
But the key to that deal was that before they signed anything, Sony worked out exactly what they would be getting. So when they put out their press release, it was very specifically listed everything they were going to get. So they started off by saying they would immediately get 19 previously released albums released between 1995 and 2010. So that's the MPG stuff. That's easy. Then they said they were going to get additional titles from 2014 to 2015. So that's really the title exclusives to be distributed worldwide in the future. And then from 2021, so we're not even there yet, they were going to get 12 Prince non-soundtrack catalogue albums featuring iconic music recorded by the artist from the 1978 to 1996 era for distribution in the United States. I did say it was very specific.
So Sony reckon that they've got to the bottom of that Warner contract, and therefore they know in return for the massive advance that they will be paying the estate, what rights they will have over the Prince oeuvre and crucially the albums and singles that came out in that original era we were talking about, the Warner Brothers era.
So far, this has not ended up in court, but as we say, some of it isn't going to come into action until 2021, so we'll have to wait and see. The one thing that Sony did not get was full access to the vault, which was one of the more lucrative bits of any deal that was going to be done, was what people expected. Part of that was because by then the estate had made up with Tidal and promised them a load of the vault, so they couldn't sell it wholesale. It was interesting. I found a recent interview with the archivist who oversees the vault and is trying to work out what's in it, a guy called Michael Howe, who was formerly an A&R at Warner Brothers, who worked with Prince around the time of his 2014 deal. In this interview with Super Deluxe Edition in June this year, he said that it was relatively easy now to work out who owns what in the archive, although he added he couldn't say any more due to a constellation of non-disclosure agreements. And constellation, that's quite a lot, isn't it? So understandably, he couldn't say much. Although we do know various things have come out of the vault since Prince's death and since all the legal wranglings finished, both through Warner and Sony. either as expanded reissues or standalone releases. Notably, while earlier on we were talking about Warner fighting Prince to release less music, Howe also said in this interview, generally speaking, record companies kind of err on the side of more is more, just because of the world we live in from a fan engagement standpoint. But we, the keepers of the Prince legacy, are much more interested in quality over quantity. So it really flipped.
Yes, so whereas all of this began in the late 80s, early 90s, because Warner wouldn't put out as much music as Prince wanted, because they were like, album every 2 years is the system, album a year is the absolute max.
You don't want to saturate the market.
We're now in a digital age where people want new music all the time. And so we've now got labels saying, more, more, can we release more? And it's the Prince estate who are saying, hey, hang on a second.
Let's just chill out a bit.
Let's just chill out and release this at a much more leisurely pace.
You finished on quite a leisurely pace there.
I did, didn't I?
It's almost a shame to continue speaking, but I have to tell everyone that we've come to the end of the show.
Yes, that is the Prince versus Warner story. Technically, never really properly got to court. Did in the end, although even then, I suppose, really, only because of the issues around the estate and the fact that Universal had to go through the courts in order to get out of that deal.
But as we said, some interesting tests of contract law on Prince's side. And although, yeah, it didn't really go legal in the end, it did cause some changes to record industry contracts. And over time, record industry contracts have developed to become a lot more like he would have wanted.
Yeah, I mean, label deals, I mean, as I say, major label, new talent deals, managers and artist lawyers would tell you are still very much stacked in the label's favour. There's yes. still a lot of room for improvement. But it is definitely true that as the years have progressed, even the most draconian label deals are becoming more artist friendly. And slowly but surely, more artists are being given the freedom to retain their rights, to release through their own labels in partnership with bigger record companies, exploit the direct-to-fan thing, do more of the fan club thing. So yeah, in many ways, Prince was a commercial innovator as much as he was a creative innovator.
He just didn't understand contract law
he
very well.
Just didn't appreciate Warner Brothers trying to pull him back into what he had previously agreed before banking those massive advance checks. Mm. So yeah, although technically not a lawsuit to talk through, I think when you talk about artists being in conflict with record companies in the history of the modern music business, most people, the first thing they would hone in on is Prince and Warner Brother Records.
So yeah, that is the end of this special edition of Setlist, which is the music business podcast from CMU. It's presented by me, Andy Malt, and Chris Cook. It's produced by Matt Peaty. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at unique facilities, Setlist is an unlimited production.